There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
I think anyone who puckers up their lips and presses it against their boss's buttocks and then smooches is an ass kisser.
I seem to be inept at everything except my work. I'm good at my work. So I confine myself to that. All I want out of life is a 30 share and a 20 rating.
The man's enlarged my mind. He's a poet, warrior in the classic sense. I'm a little man. I'm a little man. He's a great man.
Think of it as colors. There's black and there's white. And in between is mostly gray. That's us. Now, gray is a tough color because it's not as simple as black and white. And for the media, certainly not as interesting. But it's who we are.
Coach's middle name, Leader Fan, Fan Radio Network.
Excuse me?
And KFAN, that's KFAN.com. 2 minutes, 1 second past 3 o'clock Central Standard Time. Welcome back, Bumper to Bumper. It's a Tuesday edition of this live, local, combustible program here in the great cities of Minneapolis and St. Louis Park. I'm the host of the program. My name is Dan Barrero. Garzy is the producer. And we appreciate your interest in today's festivities. We'll give you the Borton Volvo guest lineup, as we are wont to do, in just a couple of minutes. We'll remind you the Bradshaw and Bryan inbox is open. Booth at KFAN.com. If you would like to communicate directly with either me or the producer of this particular broadcast, I can't tell you we have any giveaways today because I don't think we do. Are we giveaway free today?
We are giveaway free today, as far as I know. It could change at any moment.
We don't have any Foo Fighters concert tickets to give away?
We do not.
What's the big Foo Fighters news that has everybody either excited or bitter?
That they announced a concert at Huntington Bank Stadium.
Yes.
And then quickly said the concert will not happen because of a failure to come to an agreement on COVID protocols. Ooh. At Huntington Bank Stadium.
Interesting. So they wanted everybody masked in the outdoor stadium?
I'm not sure what their request was.
So it's off.
It's off. It will be in Minneapolis at a venue to be determined.
Oh.
But not hunting, not the original bank.
Devastating for me as a huge devotee of the Foo Fighters.
You've been waiting for the Foo Fighters to come back through town.
I frankly just like saying Foo Fighters.
It's a great
more
band
than I'm
name.
Interested in the band itself. But we'll keep you posted if we get any new information on exactly that. I mentioned off the top of the program that we are indeed your When Hubris Is a Coach's Middle Name leader. And the comeback, the snarky comment would be, well, when isn't it? Name me a coach who doesn't have that particular middle name. By the way, pronunciation key.
Oh, boy.
Is it hubris? Is the H silent or is it hubris?
Well, we got in this thing like 15 years ago where we stopped pronouncing the H on things. Like,
we did on a lot of stuff, yeah. So like, is this one of those words?
I don't know. I mean, I remember Mike Tice being the first I ever heard to say huge as opposed to huge.
Before Trump?
Yeah, before Trump.
Wow.
Tice always said huge.
Interesting.
And then Trump perfected it or got at least even more
he
mainstream.
He got elected by doing it.
Yeah, saying huge.
So he stole Tice's idea to become elected president of the United States.
Might be an East Coast thing, right? Because Tice, was he from Maryland or was he from New York, I thought?
From New York, I think. Went to the University of Maryland.
Yeah, so it's that thing. Like, I don't know when we stopped pronouncing the H on words, but I go hubris. I don't know if it's hubris.
We had talked yesterday about the big news related to the Oklahoma coach moving on to USC. What is his name?
Lincoln Riley.
And we had, out of envy and jealousy, we were discussing some of the details as they have at least been reported regarding the contract, the deal that wooed him from Oklahoma to go to sunny Southern California to take over a once very proud USC tradition, not quite as proud recently, correct?
Correct.
And it was, the money's obscene. That part is probably not all that surprising. There were some fascinating perks that included the fact that the USC deal, part of what USC said we'll do for you, Coach, is we're going to buy both of your Norman, Oklahoma homes because, as we said earlier, Norman's a very sprawling community, and it's difficult to be satisfied with just one. And not only were they going to buy both of those homes, they were going to pay, I think the number was $500,000 over market value.
Yeah.
Accepted market value as well.
Which, can you even do that? Like, I've heard, like, in inspections and stuff, things fall through because people say, well, you can't pay that. That's not what the house is worth.
Right. Well, I think they can do whatever they want.
I guess.
It doesn't necessarily mean that when they sell it, they're going to get their money back.
Right.
In terms of actually on the market.
Ah.
In any case, after we get off the air, and I don't know when exactly this story broke, maybe it was even on the way home that I was talking to Rick Bozich.
Yep.
And the word was breaking at that point that Brian Kelly, the longtime Notre Dame head football coach, I think he'd been at Touchdown Jesus for a dozen years.
Yep.
He was considering at that point a move to take over the LSU Tigers. The Bayou Bengals, as they are called. By the way, how aroused is Hobie Arteague? Isn't he a big LSU guy?
He's not only an LSU guy, he's an LSU grad.
That's what I thought.
Louisiana native.
Is he over the moon?
I would assume yes.
Or is he not necessarily a big Kelly guy?
I think he's probably pretty excited about this.
In any case, as Bozich reminded me then, he said, you know, at this point, I guess it should never be surprising the way coaches move around. Contracts aren't real in college sports. We knew that already. But he wondered whether a new, I guess you could say, bridge had been crossed in that, technically speaking, Notre Dame, Brian Kelly's program and team, still had a decent chance, not a great chance, but a decent chance to make the college football playoff. And yet he was leaving at that point. Now, since our conversation, it was indeed confirmed that Kelly was moving on. He'd already very quickly, I think as of late last night or early this morning, even before there was official press conference confirmation at Notre Dame involving the AD, he'd already changed his Twitter handle. There was all kinds of LSU-related stuff right
yep.
off the bat.
Got to do that first.
He then apparently also sent out a group text to all of his players saying, man, sorry, guys, you found out this way. I'm going to be back on campus.
I'm on my way home.
Tomorrow, as in today, and I'll tell you a lot more about it at that point. Now,
Tigers.
I'm hoping that somebody filmed it, even if it was surreptitiously. You know, I got it. In this day and age, don't you think it's likely that it's eventually going to leak? If he brought the players together, that somebody, some bitter Notre Dame player taped it, if not the video, at least the audio.
Yep.
Don't you think it's? I'll be disappointed if it doesn't happen in this case, to be quiet. Because I'm wondering, what can you possibly say at that point? You can't. I mean, can you honestly say with a straight face, I love you guys and I wish it didn't have to be this way? When, again, in this case, you are still in the running for the thing that you have offered in cliched forms is the ultimate in college football. Why we're at Notre Dame and why we built this whole thing and what it's all about, a chance to win a non-mythical national championship. If that's all the speechifying you've done without necessarily using the elite cliche, which, by the way, I think in his
statement to the team,
he used the word elite.
It's that elite program that, because of you guys.
Is that code?
I don't think it's
code. Is that his message that he would like to see PJ be the next Notre Dame coach? I don't know. But what is it you possibly say with a straight face? Because, you know, look, I have historically defended coaches who've generally gotten ripped and said, if you're in the position they are in, you do the same damn thing. ultimately, people do what is they deem is in their best interest. You can pretend it's otherwise. You can judge all you want. You can lie to yourself and say, I would never do that. But we don't know that. You might well be a fraud on that point. But I got to tell you, you're the guy, you're a college football guy. Yep. You're a college sports guy. I got to tell you, even I was going, seriously? You're actually going to jump ship with a chance to win a national championship? I mean, have you no shame? At some point, even if you feel neglected, I'm guessing he's been there long enough where he doesn't feel wanted or appreciated enough. You know how it is. Any coach in an institution like that, they've been there that long. There's a certain sort of boredom and fatigue that sets in, a little ennui that sets in that they don't even appreciate what they got here.
He was complaining earlier this year about some empty seats at Notre Dame Stadium.
And I mean, meanwhile, my ego is being stroked like never before by the Bayou Bengals. I'm even going to have a Southern accent by the time we're done in this interview process. I'm so aroused because they're telling me how great I am. And they're showing me how great I am, okay? But in all honesty, how do you tell even the new people that you come into at LSU, how do you lay out and spew out all those bleeping cliches about team and togetherness and we're going to build this thing together, the whole bit? How are you taken seriously if even with a chance, as remote as it might be, to win a national championship, to be in that final, how many we got?
Four,
you're out. Doesn't that
at some
world. Point cross a line that goes beyond all the other lines that have been crossed before?
Probably, but the toothpaste is out of the tube, the genie's out of the bottle, the line continues to be obliterated.
But it has never been obliterated like this.
The last couple of days, really. But, I mean, when you think about Blue Bloods just trading coaches and Brian Kelly, like you say, it with a top six team and an opportunity.
That's the specific thing that is new to me. That to me is the bridge beyond all the other bridges. Although, I'll tell you what, we're going to break. I will tell you about my own involvement in a story that you could argue predated this one, in which a very accomplished college football coach on the verge of playing in the national championship game came within an eyelash of leaving as well. And it wasn't just a couple of weeks ago. We'll do that. We'll prepare you with the rest of the show via the Borton Volvo guest lineup as well.
The Fan.
Bumper to Bumper is the name of the show. Look at this guest lineup today. The Borton Volvo scorecard reads as follows. Lou Nanny, 5:15, not in studio. He'll be joining us, we think, from the X this afternoon or this evening. Johnny Athletic will join at 4:15. And bottom of this hour, John Feinstein to talk about his new book called Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, Race and the Illusion of Progress in Modern Sports. John Feinstein coming up at the bottom of the hour. 1980, the University of Georgia football team hit the scene running. I think the year before they'd been like 5-6 or 6-5, very pedestrian record. And they successfully recruited a freshman running back by the name of Herschel Jr. Walker out of Wrightsville, Georgia. I've actually been to Wrightsville, and in fact, to help successfully recruit Herschel Walker, an assistant coach moved to Wrightsville. Now, I don't even know if that's legal anymore, but it was then, apparently.
It probably wasn't illegal then.
It probably wasn't, but they got
figured out a way to do it.
That's it.
Yeah.
And with Herschel Walker bursting on the scene with a ridiculous freshman season, the University of Georgia completed the regular season undefeated. And at that point, of course, there's no championship playoff. There is a mythical national championship, and it did set up nicely. Georgia taking on Notre Dame. I don't know if they were 1-2 or 1-3. Georgia was 1, as I recall it, because they had not lost the entire season. And on the eve, I don't mean the literal day before, but before, as preparations are being made to play for the, it's simple, you know, I mean, the old destiny in their own hands. They win the title. They get whatever trophy existed then from AP, UPI, whatever. Dooley gets wooed by Auburn, where he had gone to school. And my recollection as somebody who was covering, that was my beat. I actually had a beat back in those days for the Atlanta Constitution, was that it was a great team to cover because, again, the undefeated. They had like their own version of a miracle play. They're about to lose at the world's greatest outdoor cocktail party to Florida. And they get a miracle late long touchdown from Buck Ballou. That was their quarterback, Benjamin Franklin Buck Ballou, to a wide receiver named Lindsay Scott. Ridiculously improbable play. In fact, I'd given up on the game, gone down the press elevator to the field, and I didn't even get to see the play because from my location, there were so many of the people around me. I'm hearing this noise, but I didn't even know what happened. Well, ultimately, they win that game. They remain undefeated, and they are going to play for the national championship. Auburn calls Vince Dooley. And I went back today to look at what is being written now as recall. My recollection is slightly different because what's being offered up today is that Dooley was very tempted but turned it down. What I remember is he'd accepted it. Not where there was a public announcement, but that the word around the campfire was he was gone. And at the last minute, he got cold feet, changed his mind, had a very uncomfortable session with his own players. And I think that's why it was uncomfortable. They thought he was gone. And he basically said, I'm if you'll have me, I'm back. I don't know what players are going to say in that position. Bottom line is he stayed and they won the game and they won the national championship that year. But he was on the verge of doing the exact same thing. Now, I'd like to think that ultimately what stopped him was that it just wasn't right. That you've been at Georgia all these years. This is your program. You have a chance to win a national championship. You can't do that to your own players. I don't know what ultimately turned it for him. He has said his own kid, who later coached, basically said, I hate Auburn. I'm a Georgia guy. You've been here forever. What are you doing to us? I think the kid was like 10 years old at the time. So as odd as this sounds, I remember how uncomfortable. I mean, imagine in Athens, Georgia, a football hotbed then for sure, where the whole program is resurrected and people are on pins and needles. I mean, the head coach is actually, we got a national championship to play for. He's actually going to leave. Now, a little bit more room was given him also, I think, because it was his alma mater.
That and the always idea happens. Yep.
Was, okay, I don't think Brian Kelly went to LSU.
No.
Did he?
I don't believe
not
so.
Not exactly sure. So when I say this is a new bridge that's being crossed, maybe it has been crossed before, actually. But and maybe there's, as you said, the genie's out of the bottle. There's no turning back. But I'd like to think, and I'm naive about it, I'm sure, that there is a way, a way to functionally mandate that if a coach is under contract and you're going to ultimately let that coach break that contract, you'll at least demand that the contract not be forcibly broken until the entire season, however it's turning out, whether you have a national championship to play for or not, has been completed.
Well, one thing that has thrown a wrench in this entire deal is a couple of years back when they put this early signing date for football recruiting. Because it used to be football signing day, and they still have one on February 2nd or the first Wednesday every February.
But it's not as all-encompassing as it used to be.
But as my guy Ryan Burns said today on our podcast, Parent of Spare, like 15% of
why
prospects.
Why do you call it Parent of Spare, by the way? I'm confused by that.
Stop it. Stop it. That's a battle with the program director. What were we talking about again?
I think 15%
of the players sign on the February date. Most players sign basically in 2 weeks.
Yeah, and that's
and that
rub.
Has
that's
changed everything. Because it used to be you could wait for the season to be done. The day after, January 12th or whatever, you take a job. You've got 3 weeks to sprint. And
why can't we change it back?
Maybe we could. Maybe we will. Because it's made everything different in terms of when coaches get fired, when coaches get hired. And these next couple of weeks are going to be absolute chaos. Now, let me throw this into the mix.
All right.
We've seen over, because Brian Kelly's getting pounded for leaving the team, like you say, and saying, wow, nice loyalty, coach. when you're looking around the coaching world and you see Auburn last year paid $20 million to let their coach go. LSU this year gave Ed Orgeron $16 million to go away.
Well, how many years removed from a national championship? Two, three?
Barely two. Yeah. I mean, not even two full years. January 2020.
And what they're claiming now, of course, well, it's not about that. It's there's a lot of other stuff going behind the scenes, which might be true, but it's not very believable because probably those things were going on behind the scenes when he was winning a national championship, too, and you didn't give a damn about them.
Because you were winning.
Correct.
So my point is, the loyalty thing can go both ways,
no
too.
No doubt.
And Brian Kelly's
Glenn Mason.
Not, and I'm fascinated to hear Mason's take on all this tomorrow.
He'll defend the coach. He'll defend Brian Kelly.
But you think about, I mean, a handful of years ago, Brian Kelly was 4-8 at Notre Dame, and people were ready to fire him.
Right.
And then he builds it back up, and he's the winningest coach in Notre Dame history.
Correct.
I mean, people don't really think of it that way.
He's Newt Rockne, though.
He's never won the national championship.
That's a big difference.
It is. My thing is, loyalty can go both ways, too, and I see why coaches do want to go, you know, maybe get out ahead of it.
I get that, but I would still argue, and I know, because a couple of people emailed and said, well, you take the hit, and it'll die down. I get it. I understand all of that.
He'll be fine.
He'll be fine, and he'll get past it. I just think there is something especially unseemly, regardless of the fact that, you know, coaches can get pounded, and they can get bought out, all that sort of thing. When you do it on the brink of, there's like two things that have to happen the rest of this football season.
Yeah.
To pretty much guarantee that Notre Dame would be in the Final Four, correct?
Yeah. I mean, Oklahoma State would probably have to lose, and then probably Alabama would have to lose to Georgia,
right,
or Michigan would have to lose to Iowa. There's definitely a path there.
Enough there where I go,
Now, how about this?
And you're going to tell me LSU wouldn't wait? Even with the recruiting issues, you say, if this is really the guy they want, they wouldn't wait.
I kind of wonder if USC hiring Lincoln Riley
made them push
the panic a button a little bit, because I've also heard from some LSU sources that there were definitely some other names.
Kobe Arteague?
Nope. Oh. Circulating around.
Okay.
Some other names that were circulating around. I don't know. My next thought is, what does this mean for Luke Fickell, the Cincinnati coach?
That's a lot of people are wondering.
Whose team is in the playoffs if they started today and probably will end up in the Final Four. And like every coach from the Midwest, especially Catholic ones, reportedly has had his eye on the Notre Dame job.
Touchdown Jesus, man. Don't say no to touchdown Jesus.
Since he knew what a pigskin was ready to take the Notre Dame job. So has a coach ever coached against his old team with his new team? Like if Notre Dame somehow gets in and plays Cincinnati, this whole thing is going to be messy. Oh, it's going to be wild.
I actually wouldn't be as offended by that because I'd say, he's at Cincinnati.
Yeah.
He's at Cincinnati. You know, it's a cute little program. And he's done a really nice job, but it's still Cincinnati. And this is touchdown Jesus. Let's get a pause in. We might even have a chance to ask our next guest about this specific issue, maybe a little bit about some developing Tiger Woods news that is making some headlines as well regarding what he had to say on his recovery as it pertains to getting back to the game of golf. But we'll chat mainly about his brand spanking new book, his latest book, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee. John Feinstein is next here.
Yeah, the Fan.
Mentioned it during since the start of the program. Sometime around 4 o'clock or so, a major Craig Kilborn announcement will be offered up as well.
Whoa.
That's redundant. Any Craig Kilborn announcement by definition is major. We'll give you details of that probably around 4. Johnny Athletic is scheduled for 4:15 this afternoon, and Louie on your, what can you say, first place Minnesota Wild, where we are just feels like we're cruising along, even though we still don't have all our horses. We still may not feel like we're getting the best out of some of our best offensive players, and yet here we are, correct? I mean, it's
just finding a way.
It's remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. By the way, I was mentioning earlier the Vince Dooley on the verge of coaching a team to a national championship, ultimately turning down the deal. I've got to try to, I want to find, for the sake of contrast, what the numbers were, because I don't remember them, even though I was covering it at the time.
All what the
salary was that allegedly was being, thrown in front of Vince Dooley's face to take on the head coaching job at Auburn. My guess is it was about a mil, or maybe even a little less than that.
In 1980?
Yeah.
That much still? I bet it was less.
It might even be less. It's hard to say. But we've already had like different reports on Kelly, right? Because the early reports were it was $15 million a year, like $5 million more than what USC guy was getting. And then it seems to, as if since then, I'm seeing more reports that say it's about the same, like 10 mil.
Yes, like with 9 and a half.
A bunch of incentives, I'm sure, all that sort of thing.
Exactly right.
It's all funny money. As you mentioned yesterday, I don't know, you said this to me or you texted me. It appears that many of these programs have somehow survived COVID and allegedly what it has done to their budgets. You know, bankrupted their budgets. The universities are just, you know, dying on the verge of almost extinction. One would suggest that these numbers being thrown around make that very, very different. BoothKFN.com is the Bradshaw and Bryant inbox. We expect John Feinstein to join us here fairly shortly. And I mentioned we're going to get back to some, we got some new, rather intriguing analytics regarding Kirk Cousins and the Vikings and their offensive issues at the end of, well, really through much of the second half of their loss on Sunday to the San Francisco 49ers. We got some Wolves stuff to get to and a number of A-section subjects to at least attempt to discuss. John Feinstein has indeed arrived via the Connecticut Water Systems hotline and is kind enough to join us now. And as we welcome you back to the program, I'm noting that the newest book, which is called Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, Race and the Illusion of Progress in Modern Sports. You dedicate the book to three different individuals, and we've had each of them on. David Marinus, Bob Woodward, and you also note that this book is written to the memory of John Robert Thompson Jr., who fought with me, taught me, and finally inspired me to write this book. I want to start with Thompson about what sorts of conversations you guys had regarding really the genesis of putting this whole thing together, sort of where he fits in to this whole project.
Yeah, well, first of all, Dan, thanks for having me back. It's always good to talk to you. I knew John Thompson from the time I started working at the Post in 1977 as a summer intern until he died in August of 2020. Our last interview was for this book in March of 2020, before he got sick and just before the pandemic hit. As I mentioned in the dedication, when I covered his great Georgetown teams in the 80s, we fought like cats, because John was always very secretive. There was a reason for the term Hoya paranoia. And my job as a reporter, of course, was to not let them be secretive. And we had our battles through the years. But the one thing John and I always agreed on was that it had nothing to do with race. It had to do with the natural adversarial relationship between a coach and a reporter. There were people at Georgetown who wanted to make it about race, and John never let them do that. And once he retired, our relationship changed. And I always thought he was as smart as anybody in sports. And if you ever listened to John, and just shut up and listen to him, it was like getting an education. Because he was so outspoken and so smart. And in 2017, I was working on my book on playing quarterback in the NFL. So I was in an NFL stadium every Sunday. And you remember, of course, that was the year after Colin Kaepernick, and the year of Donald Trump's rant against players who were kneeling for the anthem. And what I saw and heard every Sunday was black players kneeling, 90% of the players kneeling were black, and white fans, 90% of them were white, booing. And my thought was, you know, having been around sports like you all my adult life, all my life, really, and being aware of race as an issue, was that we'd never been more polarized than at that moment. And I went to see John, and I said to him, I want to write a book on race, but I don't know where to start because it's such a massive issue. And he looked at me and he said, you might as well try to explain the Holy Trinity. And then he pointed a finger at me and said, which is why you have to do this book. And that was really the genesis of my being absolutely determined that I was going to research and write this book. Five publishers turned the book down, Dan.
Five.
Including my then publisher at Doubleday, who said to me, well, how can you write a book on race? You're white. And I said, well, one, white is a race. And two, I've written books for years on college basketball coaches. I never coached college basketball. I've written books on playing golf on the PGA Tour. I never played golf on a PGA Tour. If I do my reporting, why in the world can't I write a book on race? And that the book is about reporting. I talked to about 100 people, most of them black. And as I say, as Doug Williams points out in the foreword, he wrote the foreword, I don't pretend for a second to think I can understand what it's like to be black. But I can talk to people who do understand what it's like to be black. And I think that's what the book eventually became, more than it was about the polarization. Because what I found as I did my reporting was, even in 2021, even after what you all went through in Minneapolis after the George Floyd shooting, and I started the book well before the George Floyd shooting, but
it's George Floyd murder, not shooting, but yeah, the suffocation.
I'm sorry. Murder. Exactly. He was choked to death. Thank you for correcting me. The point being that, even before that and in the aftermath of that, even with some of the progress we've made in the last, what should we say, 18 months since George Floyd was murdered, it's still much harder to be black in this country than it is to be white. And that's what all these people. Dan, I didn't interview one black person for this book who did not have at least one experience with DWB, driving while black. And the first question, according to almost all of them, is always, where did you get this car? And, of course, the unique story among those came from Cullen Jones, the Olympic swimmer, who was actually stopped by a cop who demanded to know where he'd gotten his dog while he was walking his dog one evening. And I said to him, well, you're the first person I've interviewed who got stopped for WDWB, walking dog while black.
Right. Well, I'm fascinated to hear, although maybe not surprised, about what you heard from one of the publishers, because it is, I think, true in 2021 that there are a number of progressives who would say you don't have a right to write this book. Mm-hmm. And I think that's I understand part of what's being said there, but I'm very troubled by it, especially when I read through the book. And I view this as much as anything, you're listening through the book. Now, you're obviously putting together, you're deciding how to organize it, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying you just put quote after quote after quote together without giving it any thought. But that, to me, speaks to what you're talking about. That regardless of one's race, there should be, if you are only interviewing, for example, a bunch of white people trying to articulate this problem and identify it and sort of trace the history of it, that's a wholly different issue. But that's not even close to what you did here, which I think it's important to remember. And I do think some individuals who believe they are on a right, part of a righteous cause, are not quite as willing to accept.
No, you're 100% right. And Ed Tapscott, one of the first people I interviewed, who was the first black CEO of an NBA team in Charlotte, and who I'd known dating to his days as an assistant coach at American University, said to me, when I first sat down with him, he said, I know you're going to get attacked on the right. And that was obviously going to be part of it. But you're also going to get attacked on the left. And he said, there are going to be people who are going to say, who the hell are you to write a book about what it's like to be black? And I, to be honest, I haven't gotten much of that, Dan, because I think, like you said, when people read the book rather than judge the book,
yes,
which some people will do, I know that. But when people read the book, they're like you. They say, hang on here. He's not writing some kind of treatise on race in America. He's reporting on race in America. I'm letting these guys tell their stories. I'm using the numbers that are very real to back up the points that I'm making. I mean, one of the most articulate people in this book is Tony Dungy. And who was, of course, the first black coach to win a Super Bowl, and has got to be one of the most respected people in sports. And Tony said to me, you know, whenever I bring up a number like the last 20 NFL coaching hires in the NFL, two have been black. Whenever I talk about Eric Bieniemy, who's been interviewed for 11 different head coaching jobs without getting hired. Now, I interviewed Eric Bieniemy for the book, Dan, and I can tell you, anybody who says he didn't get hired because he didn't interview well, never talked to him. And when Tony says, I bring these things up, people say, why are you always making it about race? And he says that's frustrating to him because he's not making it about race. It is about race. And there's a difference. And in my reporting, you know, with all the people I talk to in football and basketball and baseball and golf and hockey even, with all the people I talk to, it's not like anybody said, you know, that people weren't making it about race. They were just telling me stories about their life. Joel Ward, the hockey player, who played in a number of places, but in Washington in 2012, he scored the winning goal in overtime in Game 7 of a playoff series against the Bruins. And he was bombarded with racist tweets and notes, and to the point where he was threatened enough that the FBI insisted he have protection. All because he scored a goal and you know, to win a playoff series and was black. And this is 2012, not 1960.
Hello?
Chris, I'm on the radio. Sorry about that.
No problem.
This is what happens when you work at home.
Live time, yeah, it happens, yeah.
The point, you know, and again, I interviewed the first black quarterbacks in the NFL, Marlon Brisco, who played in the AFL,
yep,
for the Denver Broncos, and James Harris, and Warren Moon, of course, and you know, being up there in Minneapolis especially, that he had to play in the Canadian Football League for 6 years because nobody drafted him coming out of the University of Washington because he refused to change positions. That was 1977. In 2018, 41 years later, people were telling Lamar Jackson he should change positions. So have things gotten better? Yes, of course they have. You know, half a dozen of the best quarterbacks in the NFL now are black. But it's still much harder to be accepted as a black quarterback, a black coach, a black general manager, and especially a black CEO in sports and in the entire world, frankly.
Let's get a pause in. Do you have time to go another segment? Because I there's a lot of specific examples or folks you spoke with that I want to get your view on how that those conversations went and why they were important to be threaded into the book. John Feinstein's new book is called Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, Race and the Illusion of Progress in American Sports. We'll be back with part two with him.